From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, Andrew Tobias offers some financial advice and a few good laughs. He's one of America's most widely read money advisors and the author of The Only Other Investment Guide You'll Ever Need. Also today, I speak with Russell Jacoby, whose new book, The Last Intellectuals, says that there's a vacancy in contemporary culture of lively intellectual writing. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Cloud Nine, George Harrison's first new album in 5 years. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Less Than Zero, the movie version of Bret Easton Ellis's best-selling novel. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Buy low, sell high, spend less than you earn, diversify, and run the other way when someone you don't know calls out of the blue with a scheme to make you rich. Some advice from my guest, Andrew Tobias. His new book, The Only Other Investment Guide You'll Ever Need, updates his popular financial guide, which was first published 10 years ago. Maybe it's become a little harder to laugh about personal finances since the stock market crash, but it hasn't stopped Tobias, whose specialty is writing with a sense of humor about money. His books include The Invisible Bankers, Everything the Insurance Industry Never Wanted You to Know, and Fire and Ice, a profile of cosmetics magnate Charles Revson. When I spoke with Tobias earlier today, I read him a sentence from his new financial guide, from his cautionary chapter on the stock market. I figured this sentence was intended as a bit of black humor, but it turned out to be prophetic. Tobias wrote, "If by the time you read this chapter, things on Wall Street have already collapsed, perhaps this will help explain why."
I didn't expect it to collapse the day I kicked the book off on the Today Show, but then the second half of that was, if they haven't collapsed, maybe it's time to take cover, because this is not a book about where the stock market's going, and I certainly don't claim to know, but sometimes even a dull-witted person, such as myself, can see that things have gone really to one extreme or the other. When things are in the middle, I have no idea where they're going. Right now, the Dow stocks at least is kind of fairly valued, I guess, whatever that means. If we don't face really bad economic times, things are probably fairly priced. But you don't want to buy stocks when they're fairly priced. You want to buy them when they're bargains. Sometimes the stock market, just to start with that, because there's a lot of other kinds of investments besides the stock market, but sometimes it gets so low or so high, and that was the case when I wrote the book over the summer when I was locking it up in galleys, that you just know that sooner or later rationality has to prevail. And I didn't know when it was going to happen, but I figured sooner or later the market was going to come down. The next shoe to drop is Japan. I don't know when it's going to be, but boy, do they ever have a big bubble to burst.
I want to talk with you about some of the changes that have happened recently on Wall Street that you think are partially responsible for the big climb and then the big fall. One of the changes that you mention is that the market's climb was built on takeovers and mergers instead of on economic growth.
Well, you know, things have gotten very heated up with kind of the greater fool theory and musical chairs. I'm not saying that the economy doesn't need to restructure itself, and a certain amount of of the mergers and acquisitions, a certain number of them, probably make a lot of economic sense. Some of them, with hindsight, don't. I'm not one who would pass any laws against mergers and acquisitions, any of that sort of thing. But the real excesses, I'm not sure they were so much the mergers and acquisitions as the salaries or the bonuses that the kids got, and I mean kids, the kids got for putting these deals together. You have people on Wall Street who, at least until recently, and probably in the future, are making millions of dollars a year. And again, I'm not against that in principle, but you have to wonder if this isn't a kind of a sign of excess. One of the reasons I thought that the market was going to come down, there were a lot of parallels with the late 60s and all that sort of thing, but one of the parallels was that people were making unbelievable amounts of money.
Some examples?
I told a story in there of this kid who, first year out of college, he got a job on Wall Street, very bright kid, good college and all that, but he got a job trading Ginnie Mae bonds, Government National Mortgage Association bonds. And he was getting paid, you know, whatever a kid first year out of school gets on Wall Street, $70,000, $80,000, you know, just kind of your basic starting pay. And after 7 months, Merrill Lynch had its whole Ginnie Mae bond desk, all the traders on that desk, for whatever reason, they up and left the company. And suddenly Merrill Lynch found itself without this very profitable profit center. And it hired some senior fellow and said, quick, as fast as you can, get some lieutenants and some young people to help you because we got to get back in this business. So one of the people he called was this 23-year-old. How much do you think you have to offer a bright, idealistic, loyal 23-year-old to switch allegiances after 7 months on the job? You know, a 50% raise, 100% raise? Merrill Lynch offered this kid $600,000, but he didn't take it. Because that afternoon when he went back and he explained what had happened, you know, he figured that they would, you know, they would understand. I mean, he said he felt terrible because they had taught him everything he knew and all that stuff, but how could he turn it down? That afternoon, his current employer matched it. You know, I could just see, he gets home. Hi, honey, I'm home. Oh, how'd it go today? Not bad. I got a $530,000 raise. You know, so that's just, I mean, I tell that story over and over again, and I apologize to anyone who's heard it before, but that is so symptomatic of the kind of just unreality that was going on Wall Street. Well, I think one of the reasons for this crash, I mean, there are a lot of reasons that have been given, and there's no one reason, so they all probably are plausible. But one thing in the mix that is underweighted and isn't talked about much is that right before the crash, Salomon Brothers announced it was laying off 1,100 people, yuppies, I mean, high-paid people. And Kidder Peabody announced it was laying off 100. Well, on top of the major depression that's got to cause for those particular 1,200 people, everybody else on Wall Street, I think, saw that. Everybody, you know, normal people were focusing on the big news and Iran and so forth, missiles and stuff. But these people on Wall Street said, wow, now I'm 28 years old. Let me understand this. I'm 28 years old. I'm making $750,000 a year. I could get laid off. I could maybe not get my – what would I earn if I were in a – I'm a bright guy, a bright gal. I went to, you know, some good school. I wonder what I would earn in the advertising business if I weren't on Wall Street. Let's see. I'm making $750,000 now. Maybe I'd make $45,000. You know, suddenly I think it changed the mood of these people on Wall Street. And since moods and psychology are so important to markets, when you have basically the Wall Street community suddenly kind of pulling up short and fear reintroducing itself after years of greed winning, I think that had something to do with why the crash was as sudden and as bad as it was.
Do you think that there was a certain cockiness that set in on Wall Street because people were making such big and quick profits?
Sure, absolutely. We lost touch of reality with reality a little bit, and when that happens, reality usually – and it happens – fortunately, it happens the other direction. When things you know, the world is going to end every so often. We're always being told this. James Dines in 1979 or in the mid-70s, the original gold bug, he said, Andy, the economy is going to crash so badly, there's going to be blood in the streets. I said, Jim, I'm from New York. There's always blood in the streets. What is the big deal? What are you talking about? But you know, the world didn't end then. It didn't end with the OPEC oil crisis. It actually didn't even end in the Depression, although, Lord, I don't expect any of that. The world's not going to end. We're going to muddle through, I think. But sometimes you overreact in the other direction as well.
I've been just hearing two different reactions. One is the apocalypse, end of the world, the crash has come,
nah.
This is it scenario. And the other is, oh, the heck with it. So the market's where it was, what, 2 years ago or something,
well, that's
or last year. It's not so bad.
You make that's a very good point because, at least in terms of the market. Now, in fact, something has happened. But here is the market today about where it was a year ago. And a year ago, people were saying, this is incredible. The market might even break 2,000. It's at an all-time record high. Whoever would have dreamed it would have gotten this high? So a year ago, where we are today, at least in the Dow, the blue chip stocks, was considered fabulous. 2.5 times where it had been 5 years ago. Now, because it went up so much and so unrealistically and then came down and the way it came down in such a terrifying way, you know, now we think it's awful. And in fact, it would be a mistake to ignore what's happened because, I mean, it would have been nice if the market had stayed just where it was. People would have said, gee whiz, still 1900, 1950, whatever it is, ho-hum, you know, what? Stability, I'll tell you, that Wall Street, it's boring, but it's stable, you know, and it's really stable. Low inflation, low unemployment, stable Wall Street. Instead, of course, by going to excess and on the upside and then having this kind of frightening technological collapse like we've never had before because we now have computers to help us do it, it has kicked confidence in the pants and all that. The good side of that is it may get our political friends to do some of the things they should have been doing all along. The bad side is it may restrain consumer spending and throw us into a recession. But you don't know that for sure. It seems like the obvious definite thing is going to happen. But actually, the Fed is putting in lots of money into the money supply to try to lower interest rates and get people confident again and all that. So in fact, in a perverse way, we'll never know, but this actually might have postponed the ultimate. I mean, eventually we're going to have a recession. We always do. And we always would have anyway. But maybe in an odd kind of way, if we would have had a recession in a few months anyhow, now it'll be postponed a year or two because the Fed won't have the nerve to let us have a recession.
Financial writer Andrew Tobias is my guest. His latest book is titled The Only Other Investment Guide You'll Ever Need. Did all your stockbroker friends and friends with a lot of money in the market take you aside before you started going on tour for your new book and say, look, Andy, be upbeat. We want more people to invest in the market. Don't give them any bad news. Don't scare anyone when you're in the media.
Well, after some of the things I've written over the years, this may surprise you, but I don't have that many stockbroker friends. they don't like me that much. No, actually, I have a good number of friends on Wall Street, and no, they don't say that. And it's unrealistic to expect the media not to report on the story. But you raise a very important point. I've said long before all this was happening, and none of this is original with me, that confidence and psychology are these very fuzzy, ephemeral things that don't get talked about too much. There is that some sort of index of consumer sentiment. But, but basically, what kind of economist is going to you can't chart confidence, and you can't mass psychology is a hard thing to write about and major in as a professor. So it gets underweighted, I think, in the mix of forecasts. I can't forecast it either, but I know it's important. And so I always take the serious economic forecast with a big grain of salt, because what they're not really including is this skittish thing that you can't put your finger on. If we all throw ourselves into a tizzy, we could... it's possible that we could actually cause ourselves some real damage. But we probably won't. For one thing, there's this marvelous apathy out there, which is good in a way. I mean, there was amazing calm in the broad midsection of the country, about this whole crash, so-called. And I think a lot of people intuitively understood that some of it was technological and all that. We have a delicate line to walk as a country. On the one hand, we got to be concerned enough about all this so the politicians realize that they really have to come to grips with the problems, and not in the politically expedient ways. The thing to do isn't to put a surtax on earning and saving money, higher income tax, because we want to encourage people to earn money and encourage people to save money. We might want to put tax on gasoline consumption, for example, because our gas prices are a third what they are around the rest of the world, and we don't really want to encourage people to waste energy. And we do need to raise revenue. So that kind of tax makes sense, and we do need to raise some taxes. The problem is, typically, politicians will do exactly no gasoline tax because I'll lose some votes. Maybe the right thing to do, but I'd rather sink this country than lose my seat in Congress, Hopefully, they're not going to go the politically expedient route. But anyhow, we have to, on the one hand, be concerned enough about what's happened to get our house in order, at the same time as we don't get so concerned about it that we psych ourselves out.
I should mention here that you recommend that the average person does not invest in the market. And you say that the way to make money in the market is to become a stockbroker. I think you admitted that the other way to do it is to write about it. You've done pretty well on that
end. I've done okay. And I'm not saying, in fact, over the long run, stocks always outperform bonds and savings accounts and CDs and all that. Even if you had invested in the market the day before the crash in 1929, 25 years later, sure enough, if you had held those stocks, your portfolio would have been worth more than what you would have had in a savings account and that sort of thing. But I don't think, except as a hobby or for fun, people who invest in the stock market should do it themselves, throwing the darts at the stock page, or let alone with a broker. They should invest through no load, no sales commission mutual funds. 70% of the people who buy mutual funds buy the wrong kind. They buy load, sales commission mutual funds. That's a mistake. And of the 30% who buy the right kind, no load funds, a great many of them make some obvious mistakes that I don't mean to. It's not that I can tell you exactly which funds are going to be so great, but I do know that what most people do in choosing a mutual fund is that they look to see which one's doing real well now. After all, how else are you going to figure it out? The problem is, very often, the one that's doing great this year is exactly the one that's going to do terribly next year. So there are some common mistakes like that. But the other mistake is you never should put money in the stock market you can't afford to lose, especially when back when it was 2,700, but now as well. Even if the market goes to 1,000 or 900 or something, you still don't want to put money in there that you can't afford to lose. So there are a lot of caveats, but the stock market is the American economy, and I believe in the American economy, and often it's a very good place to invest.
What do you think are briefly some of the good alternatives to investing in the stock market?
Well, for a great many people, first of all, you want to pay off your 20% credit card debt, for example. That's a tax-free, risk-free 20%, especially with a new tax law where far fewer people will be itemizing than used to. And even if you can, if you still do itemize, the credit card interest deduction is being phased out very fast. So that's a simple one that applies to so many people. You want to, if you don't have lots of money, first, after you do that, you want to have some money in the bank. So many people feel like suckers because, boy, if I were smarter, I wouldn't be just earning 5%, 6% before tax, no less, 4% after tax. I'd be doing something, you know, like Tobias does, you know, I mean, with an investment in a Broadway show or something, some great thing like that. Well, you know, my function in life, I begin to think, is to go into these ridiculous investments, lose my money, write about it, so you don't have to lose yours. And the reason, you know, for most, frankly, the most, after all, most people listening don't have a lot of money. They have kids, maybe, and they got debts and problems and obligations. They don't have a lot of money. So the first third of my book is meant to be, the for most people anyway, the practical part, insurance and the credit cards and all that kind of stuff that, you know, I cut my own hair. Now, I know it doesn't look great and people can't see, but it's even before Phil Donahue and the Today Show, I thought, shouldn't I go and get a $25 haircut like any normal person would before national TV? But I felt it would be dishonest because in the book it says, you know, for $11 you can get one of these little doohickeys and for the rest of your life you save $400 a year on haircuts and all that time. So for better or worse, there I was on national TV with my own self-inflicted haircut. Those kinds of things actually apply to far more people than the notion of, well, should I buy a farm in Iowa? But the reason I have all this stuff about buying farms in Iowa and the Broadway shows and whatnot is I don't want people to have their money in a savings account or savings bonds or municipal bonds or someplace safe like that and that's sensible, thinking, oh, if only I were smarter. I'd like them to have the money there, realizing that it's great that they missed going at all these tax shelters that are now coming back to haunt everybody. And it's great that they're not in, you know, I mean, some of these things work out, but an awful lot of them don't. And it's far better. It might be the same money in the bank account, but it's far better to do it knowing that you're doing the right thing instead of thinking, gee, if only I were smarter, I'd have something else to do.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your haircut, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is financial writer Andrew Tobias. His new book is titled The Only Other Investment Guide You'll Ever Need. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Andrew Tobias is my guest, and I do want to talk to you about your haircut. And here's what I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Why don't you get a more expensive haircut? I mean, are you doing this yourself just to... It looks fine. It looks fine. But, but
sure.
are you cutting yourself just to save money? Because I'll confess that I don't understand why someone like you who has so much money would begrudge themselves a haircut. I mean, you don't need to save that extra $10 on your haircut.
No, first of all... I save 25 or 30. See, you know the old joke, somebody comes home, I saved a dollar, I walked home instead of taking the subway, and the spouse says, oh, that's nothing. I saved $10. I didn't take a cab, you know, whatever. So I don't save $10 with a haircut. That wouldn't be worth it. I save 30, you know. But in fact, it's true that I could afford it, and I'm not really as cheap even as I make myself out to be. Some of my friends would debate that. But in my case, it's the convenience and the time. If I went to work at an office every day like a normal person, and there were a barbershop in the lobby or whatever, you stop in, it takes 15 minutes or whatever. But for me to have to either make an appointment or drive someplace and actually, you know, spend an hour or two getting hair, it's crazy. This little doodad or whatever that I won't, Brookstone sells them, I guess. It's just a little razor cut thing. It's so easy and so convenient. Once in a while, I don't remember exactly when the last time was, but once in a while you can get a normal haircut. And of course, most people listening think this is crazy. I'm not suggesting everybody has to do this. I'm not suggesting everybody has to drive a my car I just bought from one of my tenants, okay? He's 20. I'm 40. He's 20. I got some money. I do now. He's got no money. And this kid, but his car had 72,000 miles on it, and he needed to trade up for a new one, or he felt that way. I don't drive around very much. I'm home giving myself a haircut. So I figured 72,000 miles, I don't care. It looks great, this car. And it'll be, you know, it can get me back and forth to the airport. I bought the car I own in the world, has 72,000 miles, cost me $5,000. And my 20-year-old tenant, I don't want to drag this out too far, but he promised he was going to buy an American car with the money, because I'm kind of big on that these days. No trade barriers, but no harm in buying American either. There's some good American cars now. So he promised he'd buy an American car with the money. And 4 days later, he shows up. I don't know much about cars, but, you know, it looked to me, like, for all the world, like a VW convertible. I said, Brian, that doesn't look like an American. Is VW an American car now? And he said, well, now this was so interesting. This is why people need this, you know, need a little financial guidance. Because this bright kid, he said, well, I couldn't afford the Jeep. He was going to buy a Jeep. The Jeep was $9,000, and I couldn't afford it. They were only going to give me 2-year financing. This VW was only $15,000, and they gave me 6-year financing, so it was a lot cheaper, and I couldn't afford the $9,000 car, but I went with the cheaper one, the $15,000 car. And, you know, my eyes rolled up way above my forehead. But some of the basics like that is why this kid is going to be in debt all the time, paying 20% more for life than he need be. And I guess why others of us are not. I don't need to save the money in the haircut, but I save a lot of time, and it works out fine.
Your book solved a mystery for me, which is the mystery of those insurance commercials that you see where aging stars confess that you know, thank God their family's protected now if they die or if they get sick, if they have this insurance and anybody's eligible, nobody can be turned down.
And the mystery to you was what?
What's the catch? What's the catch here? Because I figured
you sensed the catch. You sensed the catch. Now you see, this isn't fair. You're not supposed to bring that kind of sophistication to these ads, and most people don't. I actually start out with that example just to, you know, start out at the bottom. Usually these catches are a little bit harder to discern. But these ads are amazing. Everybody's seen them. If you or anyone you know is over 50, I urge you to get, first of all, this is a fairly wide marketing group, right? You or anyone you know is over 50. Well, okay, that's a small niche. I urge you to get pencil and paper ready because we have big dollar life insurance coverage that you can't be turned down, et cetera, et cetera. And it's one thing for Dick Van Dyke to do this, at least in my mind. It's one thing for, you know, Ed McMahon and all that stuff. But Gavin McLeod, you know, he was the captain on the Love Boat. But the main thing is he was Murray on the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
A nice guy.
Now, your listeners never probably watch regular old, you know, sitcoms and all that. But everything I know about life, what little I know about life, I learned from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And here was Murray, a sap perhaps, but you could certainly trust him. And he's telling you that you can't know how relieved he and his wife are that they won't be a burden on their children because of this $5 a month coverage. So you send away for it. Turns out... There are a few, I won't go through all the catches, but one catch is you can't be turned down for this coverage, but should you die in the first couple years of an illness, your heirs don't get anything. So don't worry, we'll take your money. You can't be turned down, we'll take your money, but we won't pay anything. The second catch is they can't raise your rates, $5 a month, but that means they can't raise your rates. They can't write you a letter. They can't single you out and say, Terry Gross, we're raising your rates. Nobody else's, we're raising your rates, but they can raise everybody's rates anytime they want. Okay, little catch. But the biggest thing is, the chances are they won't, let's assume they don't raise the rates, and let's assume that you don't die in the first couple of years. You're 50 years old now. You pay $5 a month for 25 years. That's $1,500, plus the magic of compound interest. It's zooming into the stratosphere. And now, finally, age 75, chances are you won't, but maybe you really do die of a heart attack. How much do you think your heirs get? After all this, they get
$225.
$225? $225. And Murray can't tell you, because see that your rates can't go up, but the coverage goes down each year. Because as you get older, you might actually die. They don't want to actually have to pay any money out or any appreciable amount of money. So Murray, who was making $80,000 an episode at this peak with the Love Boat, when he was captain of the Love Boat, Murray can't tell you how relieved he is that he and his wife won't be a burden on their kids because of this $225.
One of the things that shocked me that you uncovered is that he gets a commission on every toll-free call made to that 1-800
they
number.
They get, as best I could tell, the two or three guys who do this get $25,000 flat amount, and then they get a little bit for every call, so that all told they get about $150,000, $200,000 for doing this. And the P.S., oh, incidentally, so you get the letter, and both Dick Van Dyke and Gavin McLeod have almost the identical P.S. at their end of the letter. Joe Biden may have the same thing in mind, I don't know, but at the end of the letter they both say identically, they say, I am paid for this endorsement. But I think you know that I would never speak out for something I didn't believe in with all my heart. Well, I mean, I frankly still don't know the answer. I guess I may hear from him one day after the way I've been writing about it and talking about it. And this is not the most sophisticated thing in the book. Nonetheless, if you can't, the point is, if you can't trust Murray, whom can you trust? You really have to take control of your own finances. You really have to take responsibility for your own money.
You're one of the few economic writers, business writers, financial writers who cover the subject with a sense of humor. And how do those two things come together for you?
Well, it reminds me,
there was a review of your book someplace, I forget where, that said, why doesn't he just become a comedian?
Well, great. I may have to. At the rate I'm going, I may have to. If the corn doesn't grow any higher in my little farm in Iowa, I may have to become a rototiller man or whatever it is. The fact is, I mean, there is some method in all this, other than the fact that I would drive myself crazy with boredom if I didn't try to make it fun. But it turns out in personal finance, I write about other things sometimes, but this is a book about personal finance. And there, the good advice is thousands of years old, and it's the basic, boring, prudent advice that I don't know what Roman was saying, but Benjamin Franklin, you know, a penny saved is a penny earned, except these days with income tax, it's two pennies earned, or the equivalent thereof. And people don't want to read. They don't want to know, that, wear your rubbers, wear a raincoat, don't swim too soon after eating a big meal and all that stuff. They don't want to, but that actually, well, I think you can swim after a meal, but by and large, the good, basic advice, slow but steady, really does win the race. And in order to get people to read that, because usually in the books that sell are, the world's going to end and you can make a fortune while it does. That's the kind of book that sells and people want to read that, the get-rich-quick stuff and all. In order to get people to read the right advice, the good advice, which is not original with me, you got to make it fun because otherwise it's just boring. And that's why the book's so strange.
We only have a few seconds left, but do the people who are actually in the financial world always want to know, well, how much have you made, buddy? How much have you made in the market?
Well, some of them do. some of them. I got out of business school some years ago with $2,000 in debt, and I'm not in debt anymore, so I made at least $2,000. And I have a little real estate and a few other things.
You've lost money on a few theater deals.
Yes, although, you know, the amazing, this nonsense that I write about in there, I fully expected, I mean, all the Broadway shows normally, you're throwing your money down the drain. I invested in a Broadway musical comedy about four dead nuns. I hasten to add, it's pro-nun. It is not an anti-Catholic thing. It's now playing in 22 cities around the world. I'm making more money from this than I can't. And every time I get a check, I just burst into hysterical laughter. The notion that I could be actually making money on a Broadway show about, you'll forgive it, four dead nuns. Anyway, nonsense it's called.
Oh, boy. That's funny. I should just mention briefly that you urge readers in your book to not invest in shows because...
No, as a contribution to the arts, it's fine.
You've never made money to it.
Up until nonsense, I never made...
But now you're making money.
As a contribution to the arts, and there were reasons, but anyway, as a contribution to the arts, that's all.
Okay, Andrew Tobias, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Andrew Tobias, who writes about personal finances and also has done several investigative books about various aspects of business and insurance. His new book is titled The Only Other Investment Guide You'll Ever Need, and it's just been published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actress Colleen Dewhurst, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, author Russell Jacoby says today's intellectuals are talking to themselves instead of to the public. His new book, The Last Intellectuals, is about the intellectual vacancy in contemporary culture. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews George Harrison's new album, Cloud Nine. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the movie adaptation of Bret Easton Ellis' best-selling novel, Less Than Zero. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Calling him the best Secretary of Defense in the history of our nation, President Reagan today announced the resignation of Caspar Weinberger. Weinberger says he is leaving the administration after 7 years to spend more time with his wife, Jane. She is suffering from a number of ailments. Weinberger presided over one of the largest military buildups in history. Today at the White House, he praised President Reagan for promoting the huge increase in defense spending.
You steadfastly kept us to the goal of deployment of your strategic defense initiative, toward which we are making very great progress very rapidly. And you refused all temptations, Soviet or otherwise, to be diverted from that deployment. You never hesitated to take unpopular paths, nor to violate the conventional wisdom, because you recognize that principle must come ahead of what's popular, and that the conventional wisdom is not always wise.
President Reagan has picked National Security Advisor Frank Carlucci to replace Weinberger. Senate sources say his confirmation is almost certain. Carlucci's deputy, Colin Powell, will be promoted to replace his boss. Today is the deadline for the Central American nations to announce the final measures they are taking to implement the peace plan for the region. In the United Nations, the United States renewed its call that Nicaragua take serious steps towards peace. In Nicaragua, President Daniel Ortega returned from Moscow with the announcement that he has received promises of continued Soviet aid to help Nicaragua fight the U.S.-backed Contra rebels. The Contras announced today that they will step up their fight against Ortega's Sandinista government. In El Salvador, the news was perhaps a bit more hopeful. President José Napoleón Duarte announced that his armed forces would halt all operations against leftist rebels as of midday today. Duarte said that with this unilateral ceasefire, he is now in compliance with the Central American peace plan. Some of the nation's largest banks today announced a quarter-point drop in their prime lending rate. Chase Manhattan led the way, lowering the rate it charges its best customers to 8.75%. Senior Vice President Fraser Seitel said a drop in Chase's borrowing costs led to the decrease in the prime.
It has to do with the money markets and the markets in which we buy funds. We purchase our raw material, which is money. And as I say, those money markets have been, the rates in the money markets have been going down, and this is a reflection of that.
The news gave Wall Street a lift. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 40 points to 1985.41. Advances led declines 3-1 on volume of 226 million shares. NASA today officially blamed the loss of its last Atlas Centaur rocket on its own negligence. There's one chance left to get the rocket repaired, as Pat Duggins of member station WFME explains.
This final Atlas Centaur was meant to put a critical military communication satellite into orbit. The only chance NASA has of getting the rocket out of mothballs and onto the launch pad is to replace that damaged hydrogen tank. Since this is the last Atlas Centaur to be built, there are no spare parts for it. NASA says the rocket's contractor, General Dynamics, could build a new tank for an estimated $26 million. The rocket was damaged while workmen tried to repair a leaking fuel valve. An unsecured platform smashed into the rocket, rupturing its upper stage. This failure was the last in a string of mishaps since the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded nearly 2 years ago. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
New York Congressman Mario Biaggi was sentenced today to 2.5 years in jail and fined $500,000. Biaggi was convicted of illegally accepting free vacations from another politician, Meade Esposito, in return for Biaggi's effort on behalf of a client of Esposito's. Biaggi's sentence has been stayed pending appeal. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new album from former Beatle George Harrison. Ringo Starr, Eric Clapton, and Elton John are some of the musicians who join Harrison on this album. Here's part of the title track, Cloud Nine.
Have my love, it fits you like a glove. Joy my dream, tell me yes. Bail out should there be a mess. The pieces you don't need are mine. Take my time, I'll show you cloud nine. Take my smile and my heart, they even rose from the start.
John was the smart Beatle, Paul was the pretty Beatle, Ringo was the silly Beatle, but George was the vague Beatle, the frowning one who always seemed preoccupied with unknowable thoughts. George was the biggest fan of both the Maharishi and Ravi Shankar, and as you just heard, he's still floating around on Cloud Nine. Cloud Nine is being hailed as George Harrison's best work since All Things Must Pass in 1970, but that's just nostalgic amnesia. I mean, who listens to anything on All Things Must Pass except for the title song and My Sweet Lord? George has always put out lousy albums that occasionally contained excellent pop songs, tunes like Living in the Material World, Deep Blue, and Crackerbox Palace. Cloud Nine is a little better than most George albums, if only because it's livelier. It's produced by Jeff Lynne, who used to lead the most successful Beatle ripoff band, the Electric Light Orchestra. As a result, even when Cloud Nine is banal, at least it's energetically banal. That was This Is Love, a sappy tune from George Harrison's cagey album Cloud Nine. This is Harrison's first album since the 1982 stinker Gone Tropo. He has spent his time producing movies, writing some movie soundtrack music, being, in general, little more than a prosperous businessman. For reasons that certainly aren't evident on this album, which is primarily about living in the immaterial world, George now wants a hit record. Perhaps this is what permits him to exploit his Beatle days so shamelessly on Cloud Nine. In particular on a song called When We Was Fab.
Back then, long time ago, when grass was green, woke up in a daze, arrived like strangers in the night. Fab. Long time ago, when we was fab.
I think it's significant that when George wants to evoke his Fab Four days on that song, he imitates the music John and Paul wrote, songs like I Am the Walrus and Strawberry Fields. Those songs dealt with rock and roll informed by a wit and a dread fueled by drugs, LSD in particular. In the current overfed 20th anniversary issue of Rolling Stone, George goes on and on about how LSD was more important to his life than Beatlemania. He loved the escape from reality, a love still felt in new songs like Someplace Else, That's What It Takes, which includes the recurring line, We Gotta Get Out of This World Together, and of course the title song of the album. But I think the best song on Cloud Nine is the one most concerned with the real world, a tune that sneers at the blue noses who want to take the devil out of rock and roll. It's called Devil's Radio.
Gossip, gossip, gossip,
You'd think he'd have learned by now. Whenever George comes down off cloud nine, he makes good music. When the vague Beatle gets specific, he's a rocker to be reckoned with.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
I got my mind set on you.
I got my mind set on you.
I got my mind set on you.
Got my mind set on you.
But it's gonna take money. A whole lot of spending money. It's gonna take plenty of money. Right, child. It's gonna take time, whole lot of precious time. It's gonna take...
This is Fresh Air. When Russell Jacoby was coming of age in the early 60s, he read many of the leading intellectuals of the time. These intellectuals had a public forum in popular magazines. Their books were frequently bestsellers. But today, Jacoby is concerned that no intellectuals from his generation have emerged to take their place. In his new book, The Last Intellectuals, American Culture in the Age of Academe, Jacoby says that today's younger intellectuals speak only to each other in a specialized academic language that most people find incomprehensible. He says there's a vacancy in our culture, no public intellectual leadership or lively debate.
I am talking about a species of intellectuals, someone who speaks to a large audience, who tries to write in a public idiom. That is, who tries to write in a way that the educated audience can understand, as opposed to a technical writing, as opposed to a more insular kind of prose.
Who are the people who you consider to be the last great public intellectuals?
Well, that's a bit a loaded question, but I do identify intellectuals who I'm calling almost the last intellectuals, those who matured in the 1950s, people like Kenneth Galbraith, people like Irving Howe, people like C. Wright Mills, even. The classic intellectuals I'm calling are people like Edmund Wilson and Lewis Mumford. And the problem, which I guess we will get to, is that I don't see successors to them.
What has convinced you that there are no longer any public intellectuals?
Well, you're making it sound a little more definitive than I have stated it. I simply have tried to examine the various forms of cultural expression. Take literary criticism. One can see a tradition which goes up through Lionel Trilling, and then one sees afterwards specialists of various types. Once you can ask people, who are the leading younger literary critics today? Well, most of the answers will be people who are not generally known outside of English departments or comparative literature departments. And this is true almost in every field of economics, sociology, and philosophy.
What about someone like James Wolcott, who's writing for a magazine, Vanity Fair, and is, you know, I think, and is generally considered to be a very, very, very important, really deep-thinking, also humorous literary critic?
Well, there are contenders. I mean, there certainly are, and this has been one of the things that reviewers have hit me on. They say, well, what about the following people?
Yeah.
And when you're dealing in broad cultural generalizations, I am not presenting an ironclad case. There are no public intellectuals. I think there isn't a generation of younger intellectuals. And this is particularly ironic because it's partially the 60s generation, which once was so visible, and yet intellectually as a generation, it seems almost invisible.
Let's look at some of the causes that you suggest are responsible for the shortage of a younger generation of intellectuals. One of the causes is that you think bohemia is disappearing. Like, bohemia is like Greenwich Village are disappearing.
Right, right. That the urban geography, the habitat for American intellectuals, which was traditionally Bohemia in not simply New York, but Chicago, San Francisco, even Los Angeles, as well as other cities, that due to the transformation of the cities, Bohemia is no longer a possible living spot. I mean, one either needs a fat income or subsidies or whatnot. That is, it would be simply suicide for a young intellectual to say, I am going to move to New York or San Francisco and write book reviews and live in an apartment. But I think it is the urban geography is certainly one part of the story which has herded younger intellectuals away from the cities to the campuses.
Now, you've given up on college campuses as far as being a center for intellectuals that speak to the public. You've taught at many of them.
Yeah.
But what are some of your gripes with colleges now?
Well, perhaps you're being harsher than I am. I haven't given up. I can see that the younger intellectuals, which once were in cities and bohemias, are now on campuses. And this has affected the kind of writing, the kind of thinking they have done, so that, ironically, you do have many more intellectuals today in the sense of people who are concerned with reading and writing, but you have less public intellectuals because the academic intellectuals are oriented towards specialties, towards their profession, which has diverted them from larger issues.
I would propose that a lot of today's intellectuals are writing for newspapers, magazines, and that they're writing in places that you wouldn't expect to find, quote, intellectuals, that they're writing film criticism and rock criticism and articles about sexual politics.
Right. I half agree. Perhaps I more than half agree. Certainly, if you look at the gamut of journalism, there are intellectuals everywhere. But again, I'm taking a certain type intellectual who do reach out to a larger public. And even though it's true, and I think it is, it's all to the good that there are people active in a series of specialties and areas, it still doesn't add up. Their audiences are smaller.
But if their audiences are smaller, isn't that because of the way culture has become more specialized? It's not a fault of their thinking or of their writing necessarily.
I think
the publishing industry has changed. Doesn't that have something to do with it?
Yes. I don't want to sound like a moralizer. That is, I'm not simply indicting either academic intellectuals or journalists. The point is they, and in that sense, we are responding to a transformation of culture. Nevertheless, I don't believe that it's a one-way street. They say we must shrug our shoulders and say, well, the audience has shifted, the cultural industries have shifted, and we must shift with them.
I wonder if you're maybe looking too much for something that's a facsimile of the old voices that you're talking about. For instance, one of the people who I'd consider to be one of the great thinkers of the younger generation would be Art Spiegelman, who's really a comic book artist and writer. He did the book Mouse and edits the comic anthology Raw. But what he does is a terrific commentary on the human condition. But if you're going to compare him to John Kenneth Galbraith, I mean, they're not speaking in the same kind of voice. They're not using the same kind of forum. But that doesn't make Spiegelman any less worthy of our time. Do you know what I mean? Or any less important to read? If you see what I mean.
I see perfectly what you mean, but I don't think it's either or. Which is to say, yes, there are cartoonists, there are rock critics, which perhaps is more vital than ever. And yet, if you say that sort of an old-style intellectual life is disappearing, I don't think these completely replace it.
But I really think that you're letting a kind of generational bias interfere here. For me, for instance, Ellen Willis's essays on feminism were much more important than Betty Friedan's. And, as powerfully felt, brilliantly written,
And more meaningful to me and probably many women in my generation.
But see, that may be a generational bias as well, because Ellen Willis...
But you're talking about a younger generation, so...
Yes, but I'm saying Ellen Willis, I mean, she continues to write, but she would be an example that, yes, talented, good writer, and yet also has not quite, you know, made the transition to something larger. And I think this is true. And I speak, you know, as part of the story, not as above it or, you know, exempt from it.
Have you gotten calls from writers around the country who want to nominate themselves as part of the new breed of intellectuals?
Yes. Well, this is many people respond very defensively, like, you know, what about me and my friends? Aren't we the people? And I responded as I respond. First of all, there can be exceptions, which it's not a total argument. On the other hand, if you actually look at them, I don't think it adds up to a generational presence.
Russell Jacoby's new book is titled The Last Intellectuals, American Culture in the Age of Academe. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Alex Chadwick is co-hosting tonight's program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
From Managua, Nicaragua, NPR's Tom Gelton will be reporting on new efforts down there. There is an important deadline today in the Central American Peace Plan. Tom will have that story. From here in Washington, NPR's Richard Gonzalez will be covering new administration thinking on aid to the Contra rebels fighting the government of Nicaragua. You may know that the Defense Secretary, Caspar Weinberger, has resigned his position today. We'll have that story. And we'll have a conversation with the president of the Bobsledding Federation of Jamaica.
Okay, thanks, Alex. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our film critic, Stephen Schiff, has a review of Less Than Zero. It's a new movie based on the 1984 best-selling novel of the same name by the young author Bret Easton Ellis.
Sometimes Hollywood just seems to be going through the motions. There's a big new book or play or trend. It's hot. The kids are eating it up. Naturally, it has to be a movie, even if it's virtually unfilmable. That was certainly the case with Bret Easton Ellis's fast-selling novel Less Than Zero. Ellis wrote it during his undergrad years at Bennington, and the book was a loud, alienated moan about the decadence of modern youth, their drugs, their hotsy-totsy nightlife, their polymorphous perversity, the meaninglessness of it all. The book's hero, Clay, was a rich college kid visiting his old Beverly Hills stomping ground during Christmas break, and he was as deadpan and unfeeling as all the other characters he slept and snorted with. But deadpan, unfeeling heroes don't work in movies. So the screenwriter, Harley Payton, has named his hero Brett, after the book's glum author, and turned him into a shy, concerned, upstanding white knight. In the movie, Brett turns out to be a real moral crusader, who comes home for Christmas only to find his girlfriend, played by Jamie Gertz, on cocaine, and his old buddy Julian, played by Robert Downey Jr., $50,000 in debt to a nefarious drug dealer. Can Brett save his two old pals? Will he bore us to death trying? The answer to both questions is almost.
Make me understand, Julian. I really want to understand.
No, you don't.
You look like a Rip made me do that. It's not like I had a choice. Man, you did it. You did it to yourself, and you know it. Run away. That's what you're really good at. It's what you always do. I'm not coming after you. Not anymore. Not
well, you don't know.
Well, tell me.
You don't know. Forget it.
Get in the car.
Leave me alone.
What are you going to do now? Are you going to go back to Rick? Are you going to run and hide? I really want to know what you're going to do now.
I'll tell you that one. I don't know.
Come with me. Just leave with me. I'll take you back to school. There's no reason for you to stay. Not here, not in L.A. It's over. Let's go.
Do I look like I'm ready for homework?
At bottom, Less Than Zero is about nothing more than the heartbreak of losing your high school friends. Sad, but not earth-shaking. But, like Bret Easton Ellis before him, director Marek Kanievska is intent on shaking some earth by dressing up the movie's featherweight themes with drugs and money and sinister music for maximum heaviosity. The result is a turgid, sour, lifeless movie in which pretty faces substitute for actors, neon-tinted lighting substitutes for atmosphere, and a general air of self-righteousness substitutes for moral undercurrents. Konieczka has made the deadly mistake of casting two almost unwatchable lead actors and then trying to make up for the thinness of their characterizations by shooting them in endless, acne-revealing close-ups. Jamie Gertz is very pretty, but her efforts to work up a frenzy of post-adolescent angst are tough on the eyes. And as Brett, Andrew McCarthy manages to make his already vapid character disappear completely. The movie has only one saving grace, Robert Downey Jr. Downey is a soulful, rubber-faced comic actor who can make almost any character likable, even the hapless Julian. Julian's pain apparently interests Konieczka less than the increasingly gruesome sores with which the makeup people have festooned his lips. A movie this bad, with a name like Less Than Zero, invites the worst sort of parting shots, but I'll let you do the math for yourself.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair.
Turn up the TV, the wireless, then we'll suspect even your mother won't detect it, so your father won't know. They think that I got no respect, but every film means less than zero. Hit! 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 Hit!
Hit! Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with rock guitarist and singer Marshall Crenshaw. Even if you're unfamiliar with Crenshaw's music, there's a good chance you saw him portray Buddy Holly in the film La Bamba. Also, Ken Tucker will review a new home video for children featuring Raffi in concert. And guitarist Bob Brosman will perform on his National Steel guitar. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.